Speaker, Vice President Cheney, members of Congress, distinguished citizens and fellow citizens. Every year, by law and by custom, we meet here to consider the state of the Union. After recession, terrorist attacks, corporate scandals, and stock market declines, economic stagnation, and continued hardship, we can be confident. Our resolve is firm, and our union is strong. America's purpose is more than to follow a process. It is to achieve a man-made evil of international terrorism. Your enemy is not surrounding your country. Your enemy is ruling your country.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner, Syracuse, W201ZD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. What matters? What makes a good life? Do our central social institutions help us or hinder us in achieving it? Tonight on the program, wisdom from veteran educators John Taylor Gatto and Coleman McCarthy on teaching, learning, and peacemaking. Then some information on how you can participate in stopping a war.
From the widows and orphans, the never hard-working man I oppress. So take your pace easy, go home soon like lightning. We soon will be riding my shiny black.
This is an article by John Taylor Gatto called What Really Matters. John Gatto is New York State Teacher of the Year and author of the best-selling Dumbing Us Down, The Hidden Curriculum of Compulsory Schooling. Gatto writes, "Going to the moon didn't really matter, it turned out. I say that from the vantage point of my 6 decades living on planet Earth, but also because of something I saw not so long ago. It was at Booker T. Washington High School where I watched an official astronaut, a handsome, well-built man in his prime, dressed in a silver spacesuit with an air of authentic command, try to get the attention of an auditorium full of Harlem teenagers. It was the Board of Education's perfect template for dramatic success. A distinguished black man leading ignorant black kids to wisdom. He came with every tricky device and visual aid NASA could muster, yet the young audience ignored him completely. I heard some teachers say, 'What do you expect from ghetto kids?' But I don't think that explained his failure at all. The kids instinctively perceived this astronaut had less control over his rocket vehicle than a bus driver has over his bus. I think they had also wordlessly deduced that any experiments he performed were someone else's idea. The space agency's hype was lost on them. This man, for all his excellence, was only some other man's agent. The kid sensed that his talk, too, had been written by someone else, that he was part of what the Protestant theologian Reinhold Niebuhr called the non-thought of received ideas. It was irrelevant whether this astronaut understood the significance of his experiment or not. He was only an agent, not a principal. In the same way, many school teachers are only agents retailing someone else's orders. This astronaut wasn't walking his own talk, but someone else's. A machine can do that. It seems likely that my Harlem kids considered going to the moon a dumb game. Obviously, I didn't verify their feelings scientifically, but I knew a lot of them didn't have fathers or much dignity in their lives, and about half had never eaten off a tablecloth. What was going to the moon supposed to mean to them? If you asked me that question, I couldn't answer it with confidence, and I had a father once upon a time, and a tablecloth, too. If the truth were told, in my 30 years teaching in New York City, sometimes teaching prosperous white kids instead of Harlem kids, sometimes a mixed bag of middle-class kids, I never heard a single student, white or black, speak spontaneously of the U.S. space program. When the Challenger space shuttle blew up, there was a momentary flicker of curiosity. But even that passed in an instant. Going to the moon didn't matter, it turned out, though the government threw $100 billion into the effort. A lot of things don't matter that are supposed to. One of them is well-funded government schools. Saying that may be considered irresponsible by people who don't know the difference between schooling and education. But over 100 academic studies have tried to show any compelling connection between money and learning, and not one has succeeded. Right from the beginning, schoolmen told us that money would buy results, and we all believed it. So, between 1960 and 1992, the U.S. tripled the number of constant dollars given to schools. Yet, after 12,000 hours of government schooling, one out of five Americans can't read the directions on a medicine bottle. After 12,000 hours of compulsory training at the hands of nearly 100 government-certified men and women, many high school graduates have no skills to trade for an income, or even any skills with which to talk to each other. They can't change a flat, read a book, repair a faucet, install a light, follow directions for the use of a word processor, build a wall, make change reliably, be alone with themselves, or keep their marriages together. The situation is considerably worse than journalists have discerned. I know, because I lived in it for 30 years as a teacher. Last year at Southern Illinois University, I have a workshop in what the basic skills of a good life are as I understood them. Toward the end of it, a young man rose in back and shouted at me, "I'm 25 years old. I've lived a quarter of a century, and I don't know how to do anything except pass tests. If the fan belt on my car broke on a lonely road in a snowstorm, I'd freeze to death. Why have you done this to me?" He was right. I was the one who did it just as much as any other teacher who takes up the time young people need to find out what really matters. I did it innocently and desperately, trying to make a living and keep my dignity, but nevertheless, I did it by being an agent of a system whose purpose has little to do with what kids need to grow up right. My critic had 2 college degrees, it turned out, and his 2 degrees were shrieking at me that going to school doesn't matter very much, even if you get a good job. People who do very well in schools as we've conceived them have much more than their share of suicides, bad marriages, family problems, unstable friendships, feelings of meaninglessness, addictions, failures, heart bypasses that don't work, and general bad health. These things are very well documented, but most of us can intuit them without any need for verification. If schooling is something that hurts you, what on earth are we allowing it for? Does going to school matter if it uses up all the time you need to learn to build a house? If a 15-year-old kid was allowed to go to the Shelter Institute in Bath, Maine, he would be taught to build a beautiful post-and-beam Cape Cod home in 3 weeks, with all the math and calculations that entails. And if he stayed another 3 weeks, he'd learn how to install a sewer system, water, heat, and electric. If any American dream is universal, owning a home is it. But few government schools bother teaching you how to build one. Why is that? Everyone thinks a home matters. Does going to school matter if it uses up the time you need to start a business, learn to grow vegetables, to explore the world, or make a dress? Or if it takes away time to love your family? What matters in a good life? The things that matter in a bad life, we know, are gaining power over others, accumulating as much stuff as you can, getting revenge on your enemies, who are everywhere, and drugging yourself one way or another to forget the pain of not quite being human. School teaches most kids how to strive for a bad life and succeeds at this so well that most of our government machinery eventually falls into the hands of people who themselves are living bad lives. We're all in deep trouble because of that. It's the best reason I know to keep the machinery of government just as weak and as primitive as possible, as soon as we figure out how. It surprises me how many graduates leave college assuming they know what matters because they got straight A's. If we can believe advertisements, what matters to these people most is the personal ownership of machinery. Blending machines, cooking machines, driving machines, picture machines, sound machines, toothbrushing machines, computing machines, machines to kill insects, deliver intimacy, send messages through wires or the naked air, entertainment machines, shooting machines, and many more mechanical extensions of our physical self. Indirect control over even more ambitious machines seems to matter a lot. Flying machines, bombing machines, heart and lung machines, voting machines, and a great variety of other mechanical creations. All these devices are meant to defeat what would otherwise occur naturally if they didn't exist. They are all machines to beat human destiny and confer on human beings magical powers and the reach and longevity of gods. Do they deliver what they promise? Is human life, in a net sense, better since their advent? I can't answer that for you, of course, but you can look into your heart and answer the question for yourself. Someone has apparently convinced us that what occurs naturally cannot be the way to a good life, hence these battalions of machinery. What percentage of your life is spent talking to machines? Buying them, mastering them, ministering to their needs, then betraying them with ever newer and newer machine loves. It takes a lot of time, but what does it take a lot of time away from? Television has cost the average 21-year-old about 18,000 hours of time. What would that time have gone toward otherwise? Learning to build a house? Going to government-run school takes another 15,000 hours from the young life, 21,000 if you count going and coming and homework. What might this time have gone toward otherwise? From the very small amount of time remaining, machinery other than television gobbles a great deal. What does it give back in return? Heart's ease, love, courage? Self-reliance, friends, dreams? Here we are at the end of the 20th century, well-machined, yet lost in a tunnel of loneliness, cut off from each other, disliking ourselves, envying those with superior machines, looking for self-respect and significance. We have fewer and worse human ties than seems possible if machines justified all the time and money spent on them. I include, of course, the social machinery of school in this critique. From age 5 to age 21, there are exactly 140,160 hours. We spend 46,720 of them in sleep, and of the remaining 93,000 odd hours, 42% are spent watching TV from a chair or sitting in a school seat. Something's wrong here. What's going on? How much do these seemingly essential machines matter? What are they essential for? Each one taken separately can easily be justified, but taken all together, what are they doing to us? By mid-century, we'd reached a point in this machine civilization where we could so little bear intimate contact with the messy reality of living things, as compared to the clean simplicity of machines, that we became willing to lock up our mothers and fathers wholesale, to create a new investment opportunity in warehousing the old. What a strange thing to do with our unprecedented wealth, using it, that is, to divest ourselves of our closest human ties, getting rid of our history. In doing so, a complex circle begun a century earlier when we first locked our young people away in school warehouses is completed. Warehousing the young, warehousing the aged, good business, I know, but good for what? Does it really matter or not that our parents die among strangers and our children live penned up by strangers? Does that possibility have an effect on the quality of the lives neither old nor young who are left theoretically free of entanglements? Entanglements are, after all, the core of complete human lives. Good lives are all about being entangled with each other. The assertion that isolation chambers for the young and old are an advance in human society doesn't square with any observable reality. It, too, is part of the great non-thought of received ideas, like pretending a positive significance to the idiotic space program. After you fall into a habit of accepting what other people tell you to think, you lose the power to think for yourself. I suspect that's why so few of us challenge the premises of old age homes, television, daycare centers, and schools. Talking to machines as we have come to prefer to do does make us intimate with the way machines think. It also conceals from us the degree to which our own lives are mechanical and our own thoughts well controlled, like the thoughts of machinery. Have you ever noticed that machines don't ever surprise you after you know their habits? The purpose of market research is to remove surprise from human behavior, too. When we lose the power to surprise each other, we lose a chunk of what it means to be human. Would that matter? I want to argue that talking to machines when you should be talking to people in the natural world is what has clear-cut the Pacific forests, poisoned the fish in Puget Sound, weakened the soil up and down America, turned Cape Cod Bay into a dead sea, and burned holes in the stratosphere. Not a single one of those events would matter at all to machinery. And since machinery is what we have been most intimate with since early childhood, including social mechanisms like government schools, they don't matter to us either, regardless of what we say. If they mattered, we would stop it. At best, we're ambivalent. Who in his right mind would live without an automobile, a computer, a fax machine, a telephone, a toaster, lifelong schooling, or a gun? Everyone who winds life around a core of machinery like schools and institutions and global corporations is affected profoundly and comes inexorably, I believe, to be a servo mechanism of the machinery he or she excessively associates with. So far, I've asked you to consider three aspects of modern American life we've all been accustomed to think really matter. The space program, our well-funded government schooling, and state-of-the-art technology. On close inspection, all seem to me the obsessions of madmen more than essential parts of a good life or a good society. How did they come to matter when many things that really matter, like getting hugged a lot, are overlooked? In recent years, I've often heard that what really matters most is competing successfully in something called the global economy. Try to pass over the fact that all economies on Earth, every single one of them, including Japan's, are overwhelmingly national economies, or that the economies that seem to make people happiest and proudest are substantially local ones, and look at what you're being asked to believe. In effect, it's claimed that America's total self-sufficiency in food doesn't matter, that our embarrassing abundance of many fuels, fibers, metals, building materials, roads, technologies, libraries, colleges, talented labor, no longer matters decisively, because in some mysterious way we stand in grave danger of losing these things by becoming globally non-competitive. I will pass over the fact that with a standing army, navy, and air force of over 2.5 million men and women, a vast bombing fleet, an enormous arsenal of nuclear missiles, and a worldwide network of spies and saboteurs, it is really impossible to be non-competitive. And I will pass over our vast ability to manipulate money markets and currencies, which makes being non-competitive quite unlikely for all the foreseeable future. But I am puzzled by the rhetoric of global competition because we already possess abundantly all the essentials of a good material life, in-house, as it were. What will this global economy exist for if not to produce and distribute more material, develop more skill, more jobs, and more satisfaction, things out of which good lives are made? But these things are already here. I'm curious about the kind of human being who thinks this global economy matters, because it's clear to me they are caught up in a religious vision, a rather peculiar one, in which human nature is disregarded, along with the human needs which really matter, all of which needs are overwhelmingly small scale. It's easy to see how a global economy would matter to the spirit of mass production machinery or to international banking, with all the urgencies of those twin mechanisms, but not clear what the point of it is for flesh and blood. What if you forgot all about the globe and concentrated instead on your finding a place where you could feel at home for the rest of your life? What if you shaped your own work so that it served your spirit and the spirits of your loved ones, friends, and neighbors? In 1776, a full 90% of Americans not in slavery shaped their own work. They had independent livelihoods. And in 1840, despite the rise of industrialization, the figure was still 80%. It was hard then for any man to get rich on the labors of others, because there wasn't much free-floating labor to be had. People worked for themselves. That, liberty and independence, not wealth or comfort, was the American miracle. You know, machines can be stored anywhere, can function anywhere, and are indifferent to other machines they must associate with. But men and women have to build the meanings of their lives around a few, a very few people, to touch and love and care for. If you're always getting rid of people, trading them off the way you've been taught to trade off things, you can't have much of a life. And if you fail in this vital endeavor of linking up with the right people for you, it doesn't matter at all how healthy the space program is or how many machines you own. You'll still be lonely in the middle of crowds. If what I've said is even partially true, you'll have to join me in sabotaging the global economy and sabotaging the government schools, because schools and government and machinery makers lie to you about what matters every time. They just can't help themselves. And that was an article by John Taylor Gatto called What Really Matters. John Taylor Gatto is a former New York State Teacher of the Year and now a strong promoter of home-based learning. He's the author of Dumbing Us Down.
Living in the wasteland of the free. We got preachers dealing in politics and diamond mines. Their speech is growing increasingly unkind. look like Jesus to me, and it feels like I am living in the wasteland of the free. We got politicians running races on corporate cash. Now don't tell me they don't turn around and kiss them people's ass. You may call me old-fashioned, that don't fit my picture of a true democracy. It feels like I am living in the wasteland of the free. We got CEOs making 200 times the workers' pay. They'll fight like hell against raising the minimum wage. You don't like it, mister, they'll ship your job to some third world country across the sea. And it feels like I am living in the wasteland of the free. Living in the wasteland of the free. Where I'm poor and I become the enemy. Living in the wasteland of the free. We got little kids with guns fighting inner city wars. So what do? We put these little kids behind prison doors. We call ourselves the advanced civilization. That sounds like crap to me. Living in the wasteland of the free. We got high school kids running around in Calvin Klein and Guess, who cannot pass a sixth grade reading test. But if you ask them, they can tell you the name of every crotch on MTV. Living in the wasteland of the free. We kill for oil, then we throw a party when we win. Some guy refuses to fight, and we call that the sin. Yeah, he's standing up for what he believes in. That seems pretty damn American to me. Living in the wasteland of the free. Living in the wasteland of the free. Where I'm poor and I've become the enemy. Let's blame our troubles on the weak one. Sounds like some kind of Hitler remedy. Living in the wasteland of the free. While we sit gloating in our greatness, justice is sent to the bottom of the sea. Living in the wasteland of the free. Living in the wasteland of the free. Living in the wasteland of the free.
This is a recording of Coleman McCarthy describing Techniques of Peace and Conflict Resolution. He spoke at the National Conference for Organized Resistance at American University in Washington, D.C. on January 25, 2003. Coleman McCarthy is the founder of the Center for Teaching Peace. He teaches nonviolence at the Georgetown Law School, at public schools in Washington, D.C., and in prisons. He is currently teaching a course entitled Building Peaceable Schools at American University. He has also written and edited books about peace and nonviolence and has authored many columns and articles. In this workshop, McCarthy introduces the discipline of peace and conflict resolution, outlines a practical step-by-step process for resolving conflicts, and explores how our educational system leads us to lives as peace illiterates.
All right. This workshop is called Intro to Peace and Conflict Resolution, something like that. Colin McCarthy is a journalist who wrote columns for the Washington Post from 1969 to 1997. He is a pacifist, a vegetarian, an athlete who has run 18 marathons, including Boston and New York.
And I'm an orthopedic wreck, too.
Orthopedic wreck. He's an anarchist. He didn't say it, but he is.
Coming out today.
In addition to journalism, he is also a teacher. Since 1982, he has had more than 5,000 students, well, close to 6,000 now, right, students, in his courses on nonviolence and conflict resolution. He teaches at Georgetown Law School, the University of Maryland, American University, two high schools, and a prison. At American University, he has been twice voted Professor of the Year. How many times have you been fired?
We'll give you the details later.
Colin McCarthy is not a typical teacher. He does not give his students homework. He does not give tests or exams.
And that's
he
how you get to be Professor of the Year.
and he believes that grades are irrelevant. Instead, he believes in pure learning that is free of artificial rewards and pressures. In 1985, he founded the Center for Teaching Peace, which helps schools get peace studies programs into the curriculum. He is the author of 5 books on nonviolence, as well as editing 2 anthologies of peace essays. Hundreds of schools are using these as textbooks. Please welcome our old friend, Colin McCarthy.
Thank you, Andrew, for the warm welcome, and I do appreciate all the good organizing that you're doing with Emily and Maggie and the others. We either end up in this little world either agonizing or organizing, and the organizers are the ones we count on. And I do appreciate all the work you've done. It's a year-round project to get things underway. I want to talk to you briefly about a few of the issues with conflict resolution, conflict management, conflict elimination, and we'll have time for some questions and answers and disagreements and dissent. I do like people who disagree with me. I really have no choice in my line of work as a left-wing journalist. I get a stack of mail out high every week from readers around the country who call me a fool, jerk, know-nothing, ignoramus, idiot. And then I read my negative mail. So feel free to break in any time with the disagreement or dissent. Even though we may not see eye to eye on everything, we can always talk heart to heart. And that's what good debate's about, good discussion. And when people of goodwill come together, you have a good chance of moving ahead a little bit. Before we start, if you don't mind, if we can maybe take a moment of silence, reflection, prayer, if you believe in prayer, I'm sure many of you do. And let us remember for a brief moment or two all the people on this planet with whom we share the air, land, and water. The planet Earth, which was what Alfred North Whitehead, the great philosopher, once called a third-rate rock spinning around a second-rate fireball. Let's take a moment to remember all the people today who are victims of violence, whether economic violence, political violence, domestic violence, military violence. Let us remember our refugees. Let us remember our prisoners. Let us remember our slaves. Let us remember our people who are without homes, without luck, without friends, without hope. And all those who we know who are going through some tough times, maybe in our own lives. Let us remember, and remember the animals too, who are also victimized by violence every day. Let's take a moment to do that. All right, thank you very much for doing that. It's always good to do so. We sometimes get caught up in the rush of things and tend to forget some of the crucial ways people are victimized. And also, it's good to remember the good fortune many of us have, the blessings we have received. And if you are doing okay in this world, and I think many of you are, you have your health, you have good intellects, you have people who care about you, it's always good to remember that they came to us as gifts. Nobody makes it alone. And it's always important to show appreciation for what we've gotten. We always leave appreciation way too late. We let it go. Sometime write a letter to somebody to whom you owe a favor. That's true peacemaking. Or do a favor for somebody today for which they cannot thank you. That also is true peacemaking. Small ways. And the old saying goes, very few of us will ever do great things, but all of us can do small things in a great way. That's why it's good to come together to conferences like this. We can all value each other's gifts. Today I want to talk a little bit about how do we deal with conflicts in our lives, in our personal lives, our political lives, our academic lives. And we're not helpless to deal with those. The trouble is we don't teach you how to do it. Very few schools offer courses academically grounded in conflict resolution or conflict management. How many went to a high school where they offered you courses either in peace studies or conflict resolution? All former students of mine, I think. That's a good sign. The alums are showing up. And we have Nick and Dante from Wilson High, Dante and Nick organized the big protest at Wilson High last week. Much praise to them. So I want to run through a few of the basic steps how to deal with your conflicts. Conflict is a word, it's a neutral term. If someone says, oh, I like to avoid conflict, get them a one-way ticket to Mars, Jupiter, and or Neptune. One way, preferably. On this planet, we have conflict. It is a neutral term. When you break it down, all it really means is we need to change the way we're dealing with each other. That's all it means. And things are always in flux. Our lives change. Our commitments change. And so conflict is... it can be healthy. It's neither positive or negative. It depends whether you control the conflict or the conflict controls you. It's going to be one way or the other. So I want to run through a few of the basic steps that were taught by Gandhi, King, and many others, A.J. Musty, Dorothy Day. There are about 7 or 8 or 9 basic steps. And I want to run a few of those with you. Number one, in any conflict, define what this conflict is about. Think back to the Gulf War in 1991. You have two governments defining the conflict in a very different way. Saddam Hussein saw it as a property issue. We got to get back that land that the British gave to Kuwait in 1923. We didn't know what he was talking about because we don't know Middle East history. We don't need to know that. We're number one. It was a property issue for him. George Bush saw it first as oil. Got to get the oil coming. That didn't go over. We knew we had enough reserves. Then he switched. Then it was jobs. Oh, it means American jobs. And then he said, oh, we got to protect the emir of Kuwait. He's down to his last few billions. That didn't go over. Then he pulled out the classic line, America must stop naked aggression. That's always... You ever notice how it's always naked aggression? Never has any clothes on. It's always naked aggression. They always call it nude aggression. Really get into it. You had two governments defining the conflict in a very different way. You had two governments going like that. How can they solve it if they're defining it differently? You think back to your last conflict you had with somebody. Probably halfway through, you thought to yourself, what are we really fighting about? For A, it was this. For B, it was that. When you define, you clarify. When you clarify, you see. When you see, you can deal. Got to get through the fog. And then you can have a chance of reconciliation. But if you don't know what you're fighting about, a little difficult. Number two, in any conflict, it's never you against me. It's you and me against the problem. The problem is the problem. But we go into our conflicts mostly thinking, I'm right, you're wrong, I'm good, you're evildoer. Hear that phrase a little lately, the axis of evil, ah yes. That means we're good. I'm smart, you're dumb. I'm going to win, you're going to lose. You hear that rhetoric right now, don't you? Every day in the paper. Trouble with defeating somebody, the first thing they often think is, I got to get a rematch. And we have a rematch going on. The Gulf War is not going to begin next month, next week. It's going to escalate. It's been going on all along. I have a student in my class at School Without Walls, D.C. Public High School. And by the way, it's interesting. I've been teaching there for about 20 years as a volunteer. It's the closest school to the White House and one of the poorest schools in America. There's no cafeteria, no gym, no auditorium, no lockers, and no playing fields. Anybody go to a high school like that? I doubt it. It's 5 blocks away from power. And 5 blocks the other way on G Street is the Watergate. You got the millionaires down there and you got the power brokers here. And then be Phoenix little schoolhouse. Good scrappy kids go there though. They know the odds are against them, so they work twice as hard. One of my students there is a young senior girl, 18 years old, from Baghdad, Iraq. Her father was a political prisoner held in Iraq's prisons by the Hussein dictatorship, locked up during the 1980s because he opposed the Iran war, or the Iran-Iraq war that Saddam Hussein was waging, supported by the United States, and where he bought weapons from a little company in Rockville, Maryland and Ohio. They locked her up, locked the father up. This girl was born in the prison because her mother was a prisoner also. Father came home late 1990, a few months later, in a little town south of Baghdad called Najaf. The Americans bombed the town, tried to kill this child and her family. They fled as refugees, walked 200 miles south to the Saudi border where they were locked up in a refugee camp for 60 years. And while on the walk on the highway of death, the Iraqi Republican Guard were getting bounties to kill refugees. They tried to kill this family. She had two governments tried to kill her. Amazing story. She's doing okay now, but she tells it like few people know. They have two governments try to kill her. All because they have different agendas. And the refugees are caught in the middle. So think about it. We have common problems with Iraq. We have common problems with every country on this planet, with every government. We all have poverty. We all have famines. We all have people out of work. We all have mentally ill people. It's not you against me. Well, we tend to think that way because we have of this win-lose attitude in this country, and many other countries also. Number three, in any relationship, whether among governments or among your friends or families, list your shared concerns as against your unshared separation. What are your shared concerns? Well, the ordinary things. You may have the same dormitory, same collars, same house, same bedroom, same refrigerator, same car, same assets. Those are still there. They haven't been destroyed by the one issue that separates you. If you focus on what separates you, you're probably going to separate more. You're going to go like that. You keep thinking about it. You get angry about it. It can be the ordinary things, as we said. Are the things you've shared all along and which brought you together in the first place. That's why friendships form, relationships, marriages. That's why treaties are signed among governments. We can get along better together. It's what Kropotkin, the great Russian pacifist and anarchist, said in that classic text called Mutual Aid. We're all united. Well, we tend to get a little nervous when someone takes a little bit more than they need and do a little of that. But the assets are always there. With your conflict partners, you do not have husbands, wives, friends. You have conflict partners. And those of you who are sweethearts, tomorrow morning wake up and say, good morning, a conflict partner, can I get breakfast for you? A little cold and clinical, but that's all we are. A study done recently by the American Psychological Association has found out that the average American family has a conflict every 8 minutes. And those are the functional families. Forget about the rest, Kinky. That's just an ongoing war zone there. And it happens. The leading cause of injury among American women, you know what it is, it's being beaten up at home by husband, boyfriend, ex-husband, ex-boyfriend. It's often family violence where the conflict's the worst. You can have opinions about how to deal with Iraq or deal with Bush or deal with all these tyrants. Or the folks you're living with. It's a dirty little secret of the peace movement. And that many of the great peacemakers were wretched people at home. Gandhi was a cruel husband and father. Tolstoy, 13 children, hardly knew their names. King was not a particularly good husband. His mind was elsewhere with his kids. Didn't pay much heed to his kids. Einstein was cruel to his wives. Why is that? Gandhi had four sons. The oldest son was so angry at his father, always off saving the world, giving speeches, this celebrated father. He said, someday I'm going to get even with him. And someday he did. Got to be in his early 20s. Guess what he did? Joined the army. And that did get to Gandhi, too. They were never reconciled. And the son later acquired the disease of alcoholism and became a prostitute. Gandhi's son. Never reconciled. A Gandhi quarrel with his brother, who thought that Gandhi ought to make a lot of money from doing this peace stuff and give it to his brother. Tolstoy. He made his wife copy over by longhand 7 drafts of Anna Karenina in longhand. I think you have 2 or 3 drafts, you kind of got the idea what the book was about. And then you turn around, you have someone like a great family man, Harry Truman. Loved his wife, never looked at another woman. He loved his daughter, Margaret. I got to know her pretty well over the years. And she always told me how much her father, Harry Truman, idolized Bess Truman. Yet there's the great family man. What'd he do? He dropped 2 bombs on Japanese families. So it's always good to keep in mind who you're living with. I think the most revolutionary thing anybody can do is to raise good and decent and honest and non-violent children. If you do that, you are a true revolutionary. Because the culture goes against you. There's that old line from T.S. Eliot. I was reading a play of his the other night. Line jumped out. In a world of fugitives, those who run in the opposite way are labeled as mad ones. We live in a fugitive culture. If you commit your life to peacemaking, peace building, you looked a little bit odd. That's why it's very good to come to a conference like this. We can all feel odd together. That's why I became a journalist. It was always my goal, still is my goal. And I have a piece tomorrow morning in the LA Times about that Iraqi student of mine. It's always been my goal to make the abnormal look normal. It shouldn't be abnormal to have housing for everybody. It shouldn't be abnormal to have enough food for everybody. That's normal. So list your shared concerns. And do this before the conflict starts with your roommate, your teammates, your partners, your lovers, your husbands or wives. Sit down in moments of calm and say, these are all our assets. Let's not overlook it. Number 4, when people have fought or they've quarreled, never ask them what happened. Because you're going to get back a version of what happened. And we tend to give very self-serving versions of what happened. We're right and they're wrong. They're evil doers, you hear that? Rather, instead of asking what happened, ask what did you do. Then you get back specifics. When you ask what happened, you get back opinion. Oscar Wilde said, you can argue opinion, but it's difficult to argue fact. I teach at Georgetown Law School a course called Law, Conscience, and Nonviolence. And there we have a course called Pretrial Discovery, where the lawyers are taught how to settle cases before they get to trial. You may remember the O.J. Simpson trial. You may not have liked those egomaniac lawyers, but they were talented people. They were the best. And they kept asking, what did you do at 10:35? What did you do at 11:05? They were building the case on fact. Because then you clarify, like defining. That's crucial. So ask people, what did you do? And then you get closer to the truth. Number 5, work on active listening rather than passive hearing. Big difference. If you are a good listener, you have many friends. If you are a poor listener, you have many acquaintances. Big difference. Listening is an act of caring. Last thing I say before I walk into my classes, I say, listen well to your students. That's the first thing students want to know about their teachers. Is this going to be a listener, or is it one more in a long list of blowhards and gas bags? Students want to know right away, am I going to be talked at this whole semester? If you're in a class like that, walk out. They're wasting your time. And sometimes you got to let people talk on and on. That's okay. We all want to be listened to. Ernest Hemingway wrote that great novel. Hemingway, I wouldn't exactly call him a model of nonviolence. But he had his good days. And on many of his good days, he wrote that wonderful book, A Farewell to Arms, where really the most soulful of his novels. The other novels, he's either out beating his chest or out beating up on fish. All your English majors know that. In Farewell to Arms, he had a great line. He described a character, probably the purest line he ever wrote. He was strong in the broken places. All of us have been, are, or will be broken by life. It happens. But if you're strong in that place, or if your relationship is strong there, you have a good chance of surviving. It's important to keep that in mind, because we tend to get, oh, I'm not going to make it. Over the years, I've had many students who've had some tough times. I've lost about 6 to suicides. And you always wonder, could I have done anything different? You always try to look, sometimes you don't notice the signs are so obvious. And you always say, I should have known. There's two things you can do if you have some friends that are going through some hard times, and all of us do, maybe right now, who knows. You can do a couple things. You can tell your friends who are climbing the hills, and no matter how tough a time you're going through, somebody else has had that same pain and has made it. They overcame it. Nobody has any pain that's ever unique to only them, even though it may seem that way. But other people are going through the same anguish. And number two, if you're going through that tough time, call up somebody and tell them, or write to them, or contact them. Listen, I don't think I'm going to make it. I'm just in despair. Call up somebody. And tell your friends, if you're having a tough time, call me. We can figure something out. Depression is very difficult. But we're not alone. Number
six.
You're number six?
Yep.
You're keeping track. All right. Are you a mathematician or?
English major.
English major. We love the English majors. All right. Number six we're on. Number six is work on something that's doable. Often when you have a conflict or separation or a fight or quarrel or argument, spat, call it what you want, you often want to get it back together right away. You can't get it back to right away. It took a long time to break up. I work a lot with divorce lawyers, and I spoke to one recently, and the lawyer was representing one side against the other, and the marriage came apart, and I asked the lawyer, do you remember when the first break in the relationship occurred? He said, yeah, we always find out sooner or later. It had to be one moment. Every fire starts with one little lick of flame. Every breakup occurs at one point. And he told a story. The couple they've been married a few years, and they're having a dinner for their friends. They invite some couples over. And it was the wife's turn to cook that week, so she spent all day in the kitchen and getting everything going to be a great dinner for everybody, and she wanted to really serve a wonderful soup, get everybody off to a good start with the meal. So she gets all the seasoning in, stirs it up, and really, really devotes a lot of time to that soup. So the couples come over, they bring out the soup, and everybody starts sipping away. The husband takes his first sip, He grabs his throat. Ugh. This soup has too much salt in it. Well, it wounded the wife. It just humiliated her. And he goes on and on, and he pushes the soup back. That's too much salt in there. Well, the next day, the wife let it go, didn't say anything. The next day, she let him have it back where he was vulnerable. And all couples know where the other one's vulnerable is vulnerable or hurtable. We all know. And she let him have it where she knew it would hurt him. And that's where the split began. And then it escalated. What's the solution? Swallow the salty soup and shut up. Who cares?